from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. In recognition of Black History Month, February 1986, Soundings now presents the first of two programs about Afro-American history and culture. First on this edition of Soundings, a conversation about European colonialism and the scramble for Africa at the close of the 19th century. On the second portion of this edition of Soundings, a discussion about Ethiopia and its relationship to Afro-Americans today. The European scramble for Africa principally involved efforts by Great Britain and France to gain political and commercial control of vast geographical sections of Africa between the end of the 19th and the early part of the 20th centuries. But one element frequently overlooked in historical studies of British and French colonialism is an African perspective. Such a viewpoint is essential to the development of Western understanding of Central and Sub-Saharan African history. This, according to David Levering Lewis, who holds the Martin Luther King Jr. Chair in History at Rutgers University. David Levering Lewis recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a forthcoming book entitled The Race to Fashoda, scheduled by Random House for publication in the fall of 1986. Also participating in the discussion for Soundings is Hollis Lynch, a professor at Columbia University. At the time the following conversation was taped, the working title of Professor Lewis's book was The Uneven Combat, Africa and Europe at Fashoda, 1898. David Levering Lewis.
The Uneven Combat suggests a confrontation between Europeans and Africans in East Africa, really the Horn of Africa is my focus, between, say, 1882, a date chosen because that is the date when the British occupied Egypt, and 1898, which is the date when this confrontation reaches its peak, in October, November 1898. Now, the Uneven Combat is that this crisis, which is known in history, known in historical literature as a footnote, this Fashoda incident is extremely important, and it's been recognized as very important, but it's always received in terms of the volume of coverage, a rather limited scope.
Why is that?
What happened was that the French wanted to get to a remote Turco-Egyptian abandoned fortress in a place called Fashoda in Nowheresville, deep in the Sudan, a country that that the Sudanese themselves have said that when God created, he laughed. The Bahr el Ghazal region, taking its name from the Gazelle River. And there, this abandoned Turco-Egyptian fortress had exceedingly great tactical and strategic significance to the French, because they believed, and indeed their diplomacy during this period of time, was keyed to a triumphant march across the center of Africa from Loango, the port city in the French Congo on the west coast of Africa, on the Atlantic, to the Red Sea on the east coast of Africa, stopping at Fashoda and making Fashoda the buckle in the green belt, green being the color that the French imperial map took, which would cut off British expansion in Africa and the British design and dream of the Cape to Cairo telegraph and railroad. However, when they arrived, unfortunately, the British were just arriving there too. And so British and French troops met each other in a standoff that was potentially terribly explosive, could indeed have led to war, but did not. But I'm not interested in all of that, I must say. That, however, is the backdrop to the book.
All right. Hollis Lynch had a question.
No, I was going to say, does your title, The Unequal Contest, does it imply that the does it refer to the contest between the British and the French as well? Are you not interested in this at all?
That's
the title.
The title really has to do with the contest between the Africans and the Europeans, because that's the aspect of the Fashoda incident that has been quite ignored. When George Neville Sanderson wrote his classic on the competition for the Nile between the British and the French, and indeed Belgians and to some extent the Italians back in the late late 60, early 60s, Sanderson said that the what was left was to look at the African side of the picture. And in my correspondence with him, when this project was gestating, he was very helpful in signaling some areas which could developmentally lead to a different kind of book, a book which would look at this incident, which is a paradigm of imperialism, through African eyes and African sources. All of this happens, and the British have been, until recently, until historians like P.M. Holt, the outstanding Arabist, and to some extent Robert Collins, a transplanted Englishman, they regarded this phenomenon in an adversary way. Long after the evacuation of Egypt in the late 50s, the British have looked upon this phenomenon as eccentric, as erratic, as retrograde, as atavistic. Well, there's another way of looking at it.
And that's your way, is that right?
And that's my way. Not to the complete derogation of the British point of view, because there were pluses and minuses, to be sure. But one sees, indeed, a very reasonable, rational approach to state building on the part of the Mahdi. And even, unfortunately for the Mahdi, he was swept away by typhus in the moment of his triumph, of his destruction of Gordon in 1885. His successor, the Khalifa, is a much less sophisticated man, but in many ways much more successful because of his baraka, his charisma. The activities that go on from that point on are remarkable for their sane interlacing of the various peoples of the Sudan, the Jalin and the Taisha and the Dungala and other groups. A state is built there. Well, that's quite impressive. And even though it was somewhat repressive, somewhat tyrannical, even that is from the point of view of internal sources, people are complaining about the taxes and complaining about the nepotism of one group dominating the other. But all in all, it's a quite impressive state-building enterprise. Mm-hmm. That perspective is a perspective that's very, very important to keep in mind.
Hollis Lynch.
I think all this is important within the context of the question that sometimes asks, could Africa have, if you like, modernized without colonialism?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, part of the claim of colonialism that it is the process or the mechanism for modernizing Africa. And what David has been saying, I think, is just some evidence that there could have been new state formation, there could have been economic and social progress outside of the context of colonialism. That is to say, a stimulus could have been provided, because indeed there was increasing contact not only with North Africa and Islam, but of course also with the Europeans. I think we need to remind ourselves in the first half of the 19th century, the Europeans, the British and the French eschewed plans for the establishment of formal colonies. And this was contrary to the thinking of the time.
Why is that?
Well, it was the Adam Smith idea that colonies were really very expensive and unnecessary. What you did was develop spheres of influence. You promoted commerce. You promoted cultural contacts and sort of vague spheres of influence without setting up the full apparatus of a colony. This was, of course, this was to change dramatically.
David?
Oh, the problem there was, of course, in the case of Fashoda, the French army. There were two armies in France. There was the overseas army, really the Marine Corps, and there was the Army of France, which was concerned about Alsace, Lorraine, and Revanche, and all of that. And these young men, by far the best of the breed, these lieutenants and captains who wanted to make colonel after two or three village raids, began to determine French policy. It was a clear case of the tail wagging the dog. Paris would get these treaties exed by this or that chieftain, sent over by Colonel Archinard or Savonion de Braza, and said, where on earth, what are we talking about? Well, we're talking about 2 million square miles, fellows, and the French army's prestige is on the line here. And so the chamber would accede and would ratify these treaties. And then, though, in fact, as Hollis points out, the official policy was now not assimilation, but association. Mm-hmm. The British have the way of doing it. They don't care about ruling peoples as long as the peoples respect the district commissioner. It's cheaper that way. Look at Algeria. Look at the amount of French treasure spent turning Algeria into a carbon copy of France. Well, let's not do that in Central Africa, in Sub-Saharan Africa. But that ideology, an interesting and intriguing one, and employed in Tunisia and employed in Madagascar to some extent, was very often countered, contrecarré, by the dictates of the French Marine Corps. Africans, however, reacted in an interesting way, and that's why this uneven combat is nonetheless to be italicized as a combat. Mm-hmm. It's no secret for those people who are knowledgeable of Ethiopian history that the reigning emperor, Menelik II, was adroit in the most Bismarckian sense in his manipulation of the British and the French, both of whom would have annexed, certainly the French, his empire, as the Italians attempted to do by military occupation, but were defeated in March 1896. No secret that he was able to play off one group against the other long enough to save Ethiopia. And Ethiopia, just parenthetically, Hollis was saying this question, this perennial question amongst Africanists of the developmental capacity, internal indigenous developmental capacity of Africa versus its dependence upon Europe. Ethiopia is a classic case of, let us say, the Japan of Africa, where the technology is taken and the givers of the technology are kept at arm's distance, very successfully. The same thing was being attempted to less degree because of the xenophobia in the Sudan. Well, no secret that this was going on in Ethiopia. My contention is that, in fact, it is a belt-wide phenomenon, and that the resistance of Africans to the penetration of the interior can be dated from about 1876. As a matter of fact, my book opens in that way. Mm-hmm. By asking when the scramble for Africa begins. I begin it in 1876 in December, when Henry Morton Stanley, the great explorer, Bula Matari as he was called, sails up the unknown river, the Lualaba River. The reaction was, you come from the dead.
Huh. The African pronouncement,
you come from the dead. Uh-huh. And that general feeling of ontological fright. This is more than the Maxim gun and more than the threat of the literal death spat out by the Maxim gun. This is the death of culture that portends here, that impends. And that resonance is important, and I try to capture it over and over again. For example, Stanley himself is aware of it. He says at Vinga Njara in 1876 that he heard the weirdest cry he has ever heard in his life.
A human voice.
Yes, as the Venga chieftain says, don't come, don't cross the river, don't go up the unexplored Congo. The Arabs had prevented everybody from going up, by the way. Stanley was the first one who shot his way through. And that cry precedes him for 3,000 miles along the Congo, as one African society after another pounces upon him. It's one of the most incredible sagas of 20-odd, four or five-odd white men, a number of Arabs and Zanzibaris with their Snyders and their Remingtons sailing down a river and murdering their way through great cultures like the Batatella, like the Azandes, for example.
David, does this come before or after Joseph Conrad wrote this story, Heart of Darkness?
It is occurring just a little bit before, uh-huh. just a little. It is thanks to Stanley's record of this, through the dark continent, that Africa is, as it were, on everybody's breakfast table.
Mm-hmm.
And so as Stanley sails up and gives his accounts of being shot at endlessly and having to fight day after day after day for 2 years, blazing his way across Africa, I've been able to find what Africans were thinking as they pounced upon him.
Yeah.
And that gives you quite an interesting bifocal.
Is it a miracle of some fashion that he lived? That he survived, that he was able to blaze away, as you say?
Well, no more than that. I think it was a miracle that Pizarro and Cortez survived.
These
are pretty hardy, bloody-minded people with some very effective arsenals.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about European colonialism and the scramble for Africa at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th centuries. The Soundings panelists were David Levering Lewis of Rutgers University and Hollis Lynch of Columbia University. David Levering Lewis has completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on his book, The Race to Fashoda, forthcoming from Random House next fall. Apropos of Black History Month, February 1986, Soundings continues now with a conversation with another scholar at the National Humanities Center. Joseph Harris is a professor at Howard University in Washington, D.C. At the center, Joseph Harris is at work on a project entitled The Afro-American-Ethiopian Connection. According to Joseph Harris, Afro-Americans today are part of what historians call Pan-Africanism, or the African diaspora, in which Ethiopia plays a special role. Here is Joseph Harris.
Here at the center, I will be dealing with the development of relations over time between Afro-Americans and Ethiopians. By Afro-Americans, I mean persons of African descent anywhere in the Americas. So it's not just a question of blacks in the United States. In this connection, it's important to note that Ethiopia has a very special significance.
What is that?
That is the fact that it has a history that stretches way back into antiquity, relating to the well-known legend of the Queen of Sheba. So that with respect to the old stereotypes about Africans and blacks not having a long history, Ethiopia is an exception, and therefore it holds a very special place in the interests of Afro-Americans. Secondly, Ethiopia maintained its independence during the scramble for Africa in the 19th century, when the rest of Africa fell under colonial control. Thus again, Ethiopia stands out as a symbol of power, symbol of resistance, at a time when the rest of Africa then fell under the control of Europeans. Thus, Afro-Americans see this then as an appealing aspect of their history. And then finally, there is a passage in the Bible that refers to the fact that Ethiopia shall soon stretch forth her hands unto God. That has been taken by a number of blacks in the diaspora, as well as Africans themselves, as indicating that Ethiopia shall be the salvation of Africans in slavery and colonial rules. On the other hand, what is unique about Ethiopia, there are many things, quite apart from what I've said about long tradition, its Christian background. It also has a very old Muslim background, because the Muslims too expanded early into Ethiopia. It's significant that Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia, the old region of Aksum, represents a home to both Christians and to Arabs. Arabs who were fleeing persecution frequently went into the area of Ethiopia around Aksum and subsequently into Addis Ababa, the same as did Christians. So from an intellectual point of view, one may apply what can be called a triple heritage approach to Ethiopia. It represents a country that is old and has been built on indigenous traditions, indigenous African traditions. It also has become a kind of melting pot for Muslim traditions, a melting pot for Christian traditions. All of these then are part of Ethiopia today and makes it, in a certain sense, rather unique in Africa's history.
So when we use a term like the Dark Continent, we're not talking necessarily about race, but in an intellectual fashion, we're talking about ignorance.
Exactly.
Yeah.
For a very long time, Ethiopia remained, quote, isolated. Now, not really isolated, but most of its relations centered around the immediate area there of the Horn of Northeastern Africa. It did have relations in the Middle East.
Tell me who its neighbors are, just to bring us up to date.
The neighbors, of course, to the north would be Egypt, and to the west would be what today is the Sudan, and it touches in the south with Kenya, and on the Horn of Africa, Somalia. Then across the Red Sea would be Arabia. That was its immediate area in terms of direct and ongoing relations historically. Now, when the Portuguese went there in the 15th century, from then on, relations were established with the West.
And so what form of government existed at that time? You're talking now about Ethiopia in the 1920s.
In the 1920s?
Yeah.
In the 1920s, of course, that's the period when there was a little turmoil going on in Ethiopia in terms of a transition of leadership. Mm-hmm. Emperor Selassie, known as Rastafari, was the regent. So that the government was being controlled largely by the family until he became of age. At the same time, though, one should point out that the strong emperor, Emperor Menelik, who had died in 1913, had cultivated relations in the early part of the century, one might say from the 1890s on, with a number of European powers at a time when the United States did not have a great deal of interest. Now, you remember that a moment ago I mentioned that Ethiopia had remained independent. It had remained independent by negotiating with the European powers. The Italians were penetrating from the Red Sea. The French were penetrating from another part of the Red Sea. The British were penetrating from the south in the area of the Sudan and of Egypt. So in all of those cases, the Emperor Menelik very wisely negotiated with them, and in fact, out of that was able to define the borders of Ethiopia, which exist pretty much as they do today. So when we look at modern Ethiopia, that is the period when those boundaries are really solidified in that sense. All of which is to say then that Ethiopia had relations with the outside world, indeed with the major Western powers, but not so much with the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me see if I can pull this back to where we were. I'm saying then that by and large, most Ethiopians did not have any great sense of what the United States was until after World War I. And it is in that period when the United States had played such a key role in World War I,
mm-hmm,
and had emerged as a significant power, Wilson in particular with his ideas of the League of Nations and so on, that more and more third world people, including Ethiopia, began to look more closely at the United States. Henceforth, then, Ethiopia would be in the family of nations, so to speak, and would be voicing its opinions in the League of Nations, and it could make contact with the various powers in that body. But, you will recall, the United States was not a member, uh-huh, of the League of Nations, so that still Ethiopia was not that close in contact with the United States.
Was that a smooth or a painful transition for Ethiopia, sort of moving into the global bloodstream? Tell me about that.
I think it was smooth enough, uh-huh, because this was the first time in many years that the countries had come together in an international body.
Mm-hmm.
So except for the Western powers who had sort of operated in concert in many ways, for most of the countries coming into that body, it was a significant adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
It was a time of discovery as to how the various powers could function together internationally. So I would say that from what I have been able to see, Ethiopia did pretty well. It sat on one or two of the committees. It was not an influential power by any means.
Mm-hmm.
I think Ethiopians saw its membership, saw their membership in the body as one which would help preserve its position.
Mm-hmm.
Mark you now, it was in Africa. The rest of Africa was colonized. So it was sitting with those colonial powers and attempted to negotiate one with the other to protect itself.
Mm-hmm.
It was interested in using the British to offset the Italians who might have invaded and so forth and so on. Out of that, therefore, with the United States showing interest from the 20s by developing its consulate from 1927 on a continuous basis, Ethiopia began increasingly to see the United States as a power without colonies in Africa and as a power which it, Ethiopia, might use to counterbalance any other aggression that the European powers might have against it, mm-hmm, Ethiopia. So that in many ways one could define Ethiopia up into this period as a kind of feudalistic state. Now, when you get then to 1974, the emperor's a very old man, many of the younger Ethiopians looked around them and saw that the other countries of Africa that had become independent in the 1960s seemed to have been making greater progress. They were getting more assistance from the former colonial powers. They had greater access in many ways to the international agencies. Ethiopia was tended to be not overlooked, but it had was nothing new about Ethiopia. It had been a member of the nations. So that Britain wanted to develop its countries, mainly to maintain its political influence there, and so on. So with the overthrow of the emperor in 1974, there emerged a new group, a group that was a part of contemporary ideology that emphasized socialism. Many of them emphasized Marxism, so that what one eventually saw emerge in Ethiopia was a Marxist regime, which is what we have today.
And that's continued up to 1986.
Exactly. I like to make a point overseas, in the Third World, in Africa in particular, that although I'm critical of my country, particularly in the area of race, I have to also recognize the fact that in spite of the racial problems, blacks and other ethnic groups have had a considerable degree of mobility. So we've been able to move, been able to do things. That is a part of the American tradition. I can criticize so that a part of the strength of the of this country is a representative of a minority, of suppressed minority, being able to go abroad and criticize. So that much of what I will be writing about will be an American experience. Hmm. And I think the wider American audience ought to be interested in that. I think the degree to which Ethiopia has been part of the world community for such a long time, those people who are interested in Africa generally, as well as in Ethiopia in particular, ought to be interested in the way in which Ethiopia has helped to shape some of these developments, particularly during the war, how it has appealed. A part of the book that I'm writing will have a section relating to Italian Americans, because the period of 1935 and 36 is very important in American history. It is the period when re-elections were coming up in 1936. Franklin Roosevelt and others in the Democratic Party were very much concerned about the impact of the Italian-Ethiopian War on blacks in this country, on Italians in this country. Those were two large constituencies of the Democratic Party. Efforts were made to keep the emperor and representatives out of this country. Blacks wanted them to come to for propaganda purposes. The Democratic Party, the government, I should say, under Roosevelt, did not want them to come, did not want to cause any problems in this regard. So that race then becomes a part of the politics here in this country. I think one would learn something out of that. Overall, I think, too, especially Afro-Americans will see this as a very unique chapter in their own history. So it is a significant period in the history of Afro-Americans, in the history of the United States, and indeed in the history of the world.
Joseph Harris is a professor of history at Howard University in Washington, D.C. He's currently a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center, where he's working on a project entitled The Afro-American Ethiopian Connection, Another Dimension of Pan-Africanism. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Afro-American History and Culture, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week, Soundings on Afro-American History and Culture continues. My guests will be Harold Marcus of Michigan State University and John Sikora of North Carolina Central University. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for the first in a series of programs about Afro-American history and culture during Black History Month, February 1986. This week on Soundings, a conversation about European colonialism and the scramble for Central and Sub-Saharan Africa. After that, a discussion of modern Ethiopia and its special relationship to contemporary Afro-Americans.
The Soundings panelists are scholars from Rutgers University, Howard University, and Columbia University. Afro-American History and Culture, Part 1, this week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center on this station.